have you heard about the parting of the Red Sea? If not, let me tell you. Just when Israel had no escape from their former Egyptian masters, who were chasing them down, the waters of the Red Sea rose up like giant walls of water, and a massive corridor formed just for the Israelites, so that the entire nation could pass through. Not only that, but the walls came crashing down behind them to destroy the Egyptian army. Have you heard this story before? The Egyptians knew it. The Canaanites knew it. The Israelites knew it. They knew of the parting of the Red Sea, and they knew that this act declared the power of a God who had no borders. The parting of the Red Sea showed the power of a God who can do the impossible. Do you believe in a God who can do the impossible? I've been challenging myself with this question ever since an offhanded comment from my dad many years ago. To paraphrase the conversation, what would it be like to have the kind of faith to walk on water? Let me set up the question in a different way. I am a scientifically minded person. To my knowledge, the only created creatures that can walk on top of water are some bugs, like water striders, that take advantage of the hydrogen bonds in water to skate across relatively calm surfaces. And some lizards can walk across water, like the Jesus lizard, which uses speed and large hind feet to run across the water. The closest a human can get to walking on the water is walking across something else floating in the water, like lily pads or floating boxes. In order for a human to walk on water, we would need to either increase the density of the water, like how it's easier to float on the Dead Sea, or decrease the downward force by having something buoyant float us up, or increase the surface tension of water somehow, like freezing it. Regardless, it is, to my knowledge, impossible for a human to stand on normal water and not sink. And I want to make sure I'm saying this clearly. I am not saying that walking on water is unlikely or implausible according to our current understanding of science. I'm saying that walking on water is impossible. And in my opinion, simply walking on water is an easier feat than making a massive corridor in the sea or stopping a river for just long enough that an entire nation can pass through. So, do I believe that God can do the impossible? Yes. Do I believe that I could go out to the Delaware River right now and God could, not will, but could have me walk straight across it? Oh, that's a different question. More and more, I find myself saying yes. When I first asked myself that question, the answer was maybe. But our God can make the impossible possible. Do you believe that God can do the impossible? Do you pray like God can do the impossible? Do you act like a child of the God that can do the impossible? Did that sound like the end of the lecture? I hope not, because I haven't even mentioned the Jordan River yet. So why did I start off with the parting of the Red Sea? It's because the story of the parting of the Red Sea is an integral backdrop for our story today. First, we see that both miracles have achieved similar outcomes. Exodus 14:31 concludes the telling of the parting of the Red Sea. It says, "Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses." In other words, the great work of the parting of the Red Sea had two outcomes: fear and believe the Lord, and to further validate Moses as servant of the Lord and leader of the people. Now compare this to the account we have in Joshua 3. The waters of the Jordan are stopped in their tracks and pushed back. But why? Verses 7 and 10 tell us that the great work of crossing the Jordan has similar goals to the parting of the Red Sea: exalt God and set up Joshua as the leader of the Israelites. Though the crossing of the Jordan River serves to recognize Joshua as the leader of the Israelites, Joshua 3 makes it clear that the true leader of the Israelites is God. In fact, when I first read Joshua 3 in preparation for this lecture, I was immediately struck by the number of times the word Ark of the Covenant is used. Clearly, I said to myself, the primary subject of this passage is the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth. Since the Ark of the Covenant is our main character, as it were, I want to take a brief moment to remind us all of what the Ark of the Covenant is. First, the Ark of the Covenant is a box with some rings on it, so the box can be carried around by poles that are left in the rings. The box is overlaid with gold and has gold molding around it. The lid of the box is called the mercy seat and has two cherubim, which are heavenly creatures with six wings, and these cherubim are on either side of the mercy seat. The ark contains the tablets of stone upon which God's finger wrote the law, known today as the Ten Commandments, an urn of manna, and Aaron's staff that budded. This first description of the ark is found in Exodus 25. Regardless, at this point, I have only recounted what the ark is, not why it might be the main character of Joshua 3. To put it simply, the Ark of the Covenant is representative of God's presence among his people. The Ark is not just a symbol, but it is God's presence. This is why the Ark is housed in the Holy of Holies, a location that the high priest may only enter once a year. This is why, when the Bible recounts stories of someone touching the Ark, they die. God is holy, and his holiness cannot abide our sin. We as sinners cannot come too close to God without dying. In Joshua's time, since Israel was still a nomadic people and the temple was not yet built, the ark was only in the Holy of Holies when the Israelites were camping. To see this in action, let's read the end of Exodus 40. Then the cloud, which hovered above the ark, covered the tabernacle, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could no longer enter the tabernacle because the cloud had settled down over it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Now, whenever the cloud lifted from the tabernacle, the people of Israel would set out on their journey, following it. But if the cloud did not rise, they remained where they were until it lifted. The cloud of the Lord hovered over the tabernacle during the day, and at night fire glowed inside the cloud so the whole family of Israel could see it. This continued throughout their journeys. I chose this passage for three reasons. First, it shows the holiness of the Lord and how that holiness distances us from him in the fact that Moses could not enter the tabernacle once the cloud had descended. Second, it shows the presence of God has been long-standing. God promises his presence to Joshua at the beginning of the book of Joshua, but it is a renewed promise, not a new promise. Third, the passage in Exodus 40 shows us that the Israelites were being led by a pillar of cloud. This third point should be striking to you. Look at Joshua 3. What are the Israelites being led by in Joshua 3? It's not a pillar of cloud. They are led by the Ark of the Covenant. But up until now, since they have left Egypt under Moses, the Israelites were led by a pillar of cloud. This change signifies the change in leadership from Moses to Joshua, and also demonstrates a change in provision. Similar to how manna was a special provision for the Israelites' time in the desert, the pillar of cloud was a special provision for that specific time in history. Now, there is a new representative of God, the Ark of the Covenant. In other words, manna, which was a gift from heaven, is replaced by material bread in Canaan, and the pillar of cloud is replaced by the material Ark of the Covenant. And the Ark of the Covenant will remain God's representative on earth until Jesus. So one reason the ark is the main character of Joshua 3 is because it is God's presence among the people. The second reason is that the ark leads the people. There are a few interesting notes on the ark leading the people and how this method of its leading is special in Joshua 3. Consider Numbers 10:33-34. So they, the Israelites, set out from the mount of the Lord 3 days' journey. And the ark of the covenant of the Lord went before them 3 days' journey to seek out a resting place for them. And the cloud of the Lord was over them by day whenever they set out from camp. This passage in Numbers tells us that it is not new for the ark to be in the front. However, in Joshua 3, we are told that the ark is 2,000 cubits in front of the people. You all understand that distance, of course. Now, in modern American terminology, the ark is about 3/4 of a mile in front of the people. Many of the sources I read suppose that this increased distance is to keep the ark from getting lost in the crowd and make it easier for the whole nation of Israel to see its guidance. This is especially true because there is no longer a giant pillar of cloud floating over the ark, increasing its visibility. Matthew Henry adds two additional reasons for the distance kept by the ark. First, the distance is a sign of reverence for God. Second, the distance shows that the ark is not something to be guarded. The warriors of Israel cannot guard it because it is because 3/4 of a mile is too great a distance for warriors to quickly rush to defend it should it be attacked. No, the ark need not be guarded. In fact, the opposite is true. God is a guard to the people and does not himself need to be guarded. Another note on the ark leading the people. The ark contains the law of God. This law continues to guide us today. Furthermore, the law will be participant in the conquest of the Canaanites. God is waging war literally, but also on hearts and minds. The fundamental society of Canaan will change due to the leading of the law. The law guides us and them to a different cultural and societal structure. All right, so we've answered the question. The ark is the main character of Joshua 3 because it represents God as our leader. And we owe to God our trust in following him and our reverence for him. At this point, I want to swing back around to the idea that our God is a God who can do impossible things. Before, I mentioned the parting of the Red Sea serves as a backdrop for the crossing of the Jordan. We saw this in Joshua 2, when Rahab tells the spies of the fear in the heart of Jericho. Though the Jordan River should serve as a natural barrier, especially because it is flooded at the time of these events, the people of Jericho know that it is not a barrier at all in the face of a God who can do impossible things. And they are right. Nature itself bows before God. The moment that the feet of the priests who are bearing the ark, when their feet touch the river, the Jordan is held back and dry land is before them. As a note, I don't know if dry land means that there is just no longer a river flowing over it, or if dry land means that the river has been pushed back to the point that the ground before them is bone dry rather than muddy. But we serve a God who can do impossible things. So with God, it is entirely reasonable that there wasn't even mud left behind once the Jordan was pushed back. Also remember that God could have pushed back the Jordan without the priests. But the priest could not walk across the Jordan without God. What a blessing that God uses his people to accomplish these impossible things. What a blessing that these things are made visible to us, that we might know the righteousness of the Lord. I want to add a clarification from Alexander McLaren. He said, God does not command impossible things. McLaren's meaning is that even if the path God leads us on seemingly involves an impossibility, God will make a way. Like the priests, we need to have the faith to take the step into the river. God has all conquering powers and has promised not to forsake us. Thus, we can say that we do not fear man or devil because we put our trust in God. Continuing with the account of the crossing, the priests bearing the ark remain in the midst of the river. All of Israel crosses over, and God allows the Jordan to resume its flow. The great work of miraculously crossing a river solidifies God's promise for the conquest of Canaan. Just as he opened the river before them, so too would he open Canaan to their conquest. Moreover, the miracle of the crossing of the Jordan underscores Joshua's position as leader. Moreover, God requires that we remember the Jordan's crossing. We will see in Joshua 4 that this great work, this crossing of the Jordan, should be remembered. This event is mentioned in both Psalms 114 and Habakkuk 3, which tell us that the correct response to witnessing this great event, the correct response is to tremble. Our correct response to the great work of crossing the Jordan is to fall on our knees in awe because God is Lord over all nature. Our scientific understanding of the way nature should work does not hold a candle to the sovereign dominion that God has over all nature. And that should bring us to holy fear. That should bring us to awe. That should bring us to worship. As John Calvin said, faith means to cast our anxious fears upon his providence, raise our thoughts above the world, and embrace by faith that which we can't comprehend by reason. God's promises should be sufficient to support our faith. but he provides manifestations of his grace and might that they might confirm what he has spoken. Did you respond to this manifestation of his grace, this reading of the crossing of the Jordan? Did you respond with fear and trembling and awe? We hear of these great works over nature in the parting of the Red Sea. We hear of these great works over nature in the crossing of the Jordan. We also will see a great work. Matthew Henry summarizes events foretold in Zechariah and Revelation in this way. When the time has come for Israel's entrance into the land of promise, all difficulties shall be conquered. Mountains shall become plains and rivers become dry for the ransomed of the Lord to pass over. When we have finished our pilgrimage through the wilderness, death will be like the Jordan between us and the heavenly Canaan. But the Ark of the Covenant has prepared a way through it. It is the last enemy that shall be destroyed. Jesus has prepared us a way through our Jordan and has destroyed death. Just as the pillar of cloud was replaced by the law held within the Ark of the Covenant, the fulfillment of the law, which is Jesus, makes the way for us into heaven. Jesus is the symbol of divine presence. Jesus embodies the law. Jesus grants us assurance of God's presence with us. Jesus will lead us into the eternal promised land. And when we enter into the eternal promised land, we will be entering into eternal peace. Moses led the people into a desert, and Joshua led the people into war. But Jesus leads us into peace eternal. The great work that was and is to come must be remembered. This great work is what we look forward to when we sing on Jordan's stormy banks. And if you know it, join with me in worship now. On Jordan's stormy banks I stand and cast a wishful eye to Canaan's fair and happy land, where my possessions